Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. One number says it all when it comes to the giant income and wealth inequality in America today, $210 million. That's the exit pay package Home Depot announced yesterday for its departing CEO, Robert Nardelli. And Nardelli is widely seen as an already highly paid failure. Now $210 million more dollars for blowing it in the corner office, while most Americans have barely seen their wages budge for years. Today, Democrats take over Congress with economic insecurity and inequality standing as tall issues for the upper middle class right on down. So what will the Democrats do? Up next on Point, Robert Rubin, Will Marshall, and Jacob Hacker on inequality, insecurity, and the Democrats' way ahead. Joining me first from Washington is Jonathan Weissman. He's congressional reporter for The Washington Post. Jonathan, great to have you. Thanks for being with us.
Happy to be here, Tom.
A big day in Congress. Nancy Pelosi will bring down the gavel as the first female Speaker of the House.
That's right.
But what are we hearing from the Democrats about how they see the issue of economic insecurity and inequality, how big a role it played in their winning the majority, and what they intend to do about it now?
Frankly, they would love that to be the center of debate, as opposed to Iraq, which they have a lot less control over. One of the very first things that they will be doing next week, is raising the minimum wage, which they say is at least a movement in that direction. They're talking about, a lot of things like transferring of money from one pot to another. They want to take on big oil, which should have popularity in the middle classes and lower middle classes, and they want to slash student loan interest rates. They actually are pledging to cut student loan interest rates in half, which is another thing that might have of real palatability in the middle classes that are struggling to get their kids to college. And of course, there's also a push to try to negotiate lower drug prices for Medicare. So they are certainly aware that they need to do something directed toward the pocketbooks of the middle classes.
But is there a common agenda among the Democrats? Robert Rubin and Bill Clinton, of course, had Rubinomics, a kind of centrist, quite friendly to business policy in the 90s, and it did real well. But now we've talked with Sherrod Brown of Ohio and others who have become big critics of free trade, of globalization. Is there a split in the Democratic ranks about whether to go back to Rubinomics or forward to something else?
Well, on trade issues, there's a split. There has been for a long time. It's overstating it to say that the Democratic Party had completely coalesced around Rubinomics, this kind of free trade globalization. Sherrod Brown has not changed his stripes, and he's been around Congress for a very long time. He just happens to be in the United States Senate. I mean, this is a very tricky issue for Democrats because they understand, they really do want to do something to address these pocketbook issues. And they do understand that there's this split. Now, they've got, especially in the House, they've got a core group of Democrats that call themselves the Blue Dog Democrats that are fiscal hawks. They're conservative. They've got Robert Rubin's back, basically.
Right.
They're fiscal conservatives. They want to balance the budget. They want the emphasis on fiscal discipline, on making government work more efficiently, and on free trade. Then there's the liberal wing that would like to finally do some social spending that has not been done for quite some time. That they want to take some of the curbs off these government controls. And the way so far that Democratic leadership wants to finesse this is reach a consensus agenda that includes small increases in spending on things like alternative energy, on student loans, on Pell Grants, And they want to reinstate budget controls that Robert Rubin and his ilk have been strong proponents of these pay-as-you-go rules that say that any tax cut or spending increase must be paid for by equivalent tax hikes or spending cuts. They will try to do both.
Can the Democrats have it both ways there? This report from the House Budget and Appropriations Committee, the Democrats there, entitled The Republican Legacy, came out just a few days ago.
Yes.
And said this Congress will face a fiscal challenge of historic proportions. I mean, will the social spending have to be window dressing? Paul Krugman at the New York Times is saying, forget about balancing the budget. Spend. We've got to get the society back in order. The very big Democrats are saying just the opposite. We've got to get the fiscal situation in order. Can they do both?
They will not try, frankly, to do both in these next 2 years. Democrats view the next 2 years as a kind of a beachhead in which they establish themselves, show that they can govern, and try to win the presidency and secure their hold on Congress in 2008. This is not the year they're going to do huge spending or budget cutting. They're going to try to basically tread water and show that they can govern. They can't. For instance, one of the big promises that the Democrats have made is to severely cut back or even eliminate the alternative minimum tax,
right,
which is this parallel tax system that, you know, some people call it the blue state tax because it just wallops the eastern seaboard and the west coast.
Upper middle class gets hit very hard by it.
Yes,
no.
They would love to get rid of that. But the problem is it would cost an enormous amount of money, and they would either have to raise taxes considerably on somewhere else or cut spending considerably on somewhere else or basically jettison their promises on fiscal discipline and pay-as-you-go. They just will not do that. I would bet that the next 2 years is going to be about modest legislating and governance, and I would not get my hopes up on huge gestures on the fiscal front or huge gestures on the social spending front.
Jonathan Weissman with the Washington Post. Welcome to the Congressional Beat. We hope to follow with you as this Congress unfolds. Thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you.
Joining us now from New Haven, Connecticut, is Jacob Hacker. He's a political science professor at Yale. His new book is The Great Risk Shift, The Assault on American Jobs, Families, Healthcare, and Retirement, and How You Can Fight Back. E.J. Dionne at The Washington Post calls it the essential policy book of the year. David Leonard at The New York Times calls him, Jacob Hacker, the Democratic Party's intellectual it boy, a rising go-to voice for new policy on the economy. Jacob Hacker, thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
All right. First of all, lay the table for us here. Do we still have a problem? I'm reading in that same David Leonard's column here recently that at the end of 2006, we've got very solid pay increases. After 5 years and much more of pretty stagnant wages, 2% in the last year, a pace reached only one other time in the last three decades at the peak of the 90s boom, the Clinton-Rubinomics years. Are we out of the woods?
I'm afraid we're not, and I think that the reason that we're not is that we need to focus on the larger tides in our economy rather than the year-to-year waves. And the story that I tell in The Great Risk Shift is really a fundamental shift in our economy that has resulted in more and more economic risk and responsibility being borne by middle-class families in healthcare and retirement pensions, in their family finances, in their jobs. And it's that larger shift that I think that lies behind much of the current middle-class angst that we've seen in the polls and that was expressed in the 2006 election. So, yes, it's a good thing that we're seeing this recent uptick in middle-class wages. But if we look at the recovery overall, it's been a very weak recovery for middle-class wages and salaries, very weak recovery for employment, indeed a very weak recovery on almost every measure except for corporate profits. And we've seen a continuation of the growth in inequality over this period, and I think that what's happened is that middle-class Americans are simultaneously feeling a squeeze in their lives, but also worried about a larger shift over time in their economic circumstances that has made them feel less secure.
You know, we talked yesterday on this show about the economic prospect for this year, and it was startling how callers, almost to a man and woman, said, well, that may be great for the big dogs, but it's not working for me. Now, of course, you know, we didn't have Robert Nardelli calling in, and he went home with $210 million at Home Depot today. The CEO essentially booted there with a big golden parachute. A lot of other people, though, not feeling so good about this.
What's the problem, though, with shifting risk to families? I mean, this is America, rugged individualists. Ronald Reagan kind of set that tone a long time ago. Aren't we capable as Americans of sort of stepping up and handling our own finances?
Well, certainly we're capable of it, and we do handle our own finances. The problem is there are a lot of economic risks that we can only deal with as a society rather than individually. You know, the risk of a catastrophic medical event or the risk that we'll retire without adequate income because we're disabled or because we have a major medical condition late in our life or the risk that one of our children will get sick. These are the kinds of economic risks that traditionally government and the private sector working together have helped Americans deal with. And what we've seen over the last 30 years is a real retreat from that economic protection, particularly on the part of corporations. So even as we've seen CEO pay packages explode, we've seen the basic benefits that Americans receive both erode and change in form in ways that have focused more risk on Americans. You know, consider, for example, retirement pensions. 20 or 30 years ago, most people who had a private pension had a guaranteed defined benefit pension plan that promised them a fixed benefit in retirement. Today, most Americans who have a private pension, and again, only about half of workers have access to a private pension, they have a 401k style defined contribution account that basically means that they have to take on all of the risks that retirement planning entails, the risk of unexpected inflation, the risk of living a lot longer than expected in retirement, and so on. So that's a big shift that we've seen.
We're joined as well in this hour from Washington by Will Marshall, founder and president of the Progressive Policy Institute. He's a founder of the Democratic Leadership Council, very influential in the Clinton era. Will Marshall, thanks very much to you for being with us.
My pleasure, Tom. Thanks.
How do you see the challenge for Democrats with their new majority in Congress looking out at this economy with the insecurity and inequality that's so widely noted? Is it time for back to Reaganomics or something new?
Well, I think almost by definition, Tom, it's time for something new simply because we're not back in the 90s. The whole economic context has changed. Back then, we were concerned about enormous deficits from the 80s, about rekindling strong growth, about expanding trade, opening markets to American goods, about keeping interest rates low. Now we are concerned, as Jacob Hacker has argued, I think, compellingly, that we're now concerned with the spreading inequality and pervasive insecurity that was really the sleeper issue of this midterm election. Everybody focuses on Iraq, and certainly it was a powerful issue, but I think that middle-class insecurity may have been just as important in the end. Lots of Democrats ran their ads on that issue, and the Democratic Congress, the new Congress, is making that the centerpiece of its message as it takes office.
Jacob Hacker has some ideas on how to address that insecurity, and we'll hear them. But what about you, Will Marshall? Can you have the old instincts of Reaganomics, kind of triangulating, business-friendly, open to trade and globalization, and at the same time take on this new environment you're describing? Or are the Democrats bound to split over this? There was always tension.
I don't know that we're bound to split. I think there's a broad consensus among Democrats that inequality, insecurity are at the center now. We have to confront them. At the same time, Democrats understand that we've got to clean up the fiscal mess that the Bush Republicans have created over the last 6 years. And there is what looks to be a bipartisan consensus, with now President Bush with a considerable amount of chutzpah saying that he wants to take fiscal discipline seriously. But everybody knows you've got to clean that up. So I think it's a bit of a false choice. We're going to have to do both. We're going to have to get our fiscal house in order. And by the way, the long-term funding liabilities for Social Security, Security and Medicare are a bigger problem for this country than the short-term deficits. But we're going to have to tighten up on that front as we look to the new social contract that needs to be developed to underpin the security of working middle-class families as they try to win in this global economy.
New social contract. Massachusetts Congressman Barney Frank talking about a grand bargain with business. On the other hand, George Will writing today, say, you know, the Democrats, Jacob Hacker, have an incurable disease, New Deal nostalgia. He says, we're way past that time, but a new social contract has that ring to it. Is that the model for what you're thinking of, Jacob Hacker, somehow?
Well, there are elements of what was done during the New Deal and after World War II with the GI Bill and Social Security and then Medicare that I think are worth emulating today. But, of course, we need to build a social contract for the 21st century. And as Will said, the problems we face are distinctive to our era. I think that the problem of economic insecurity does require that we provide new forms of insurance for Americans, and that was certainly the central element of many New Deal programs. But at the same time, we have to provide that insurance in a way that is consistent with an open global economy, that is consistent with a world in which both parents are generally working, that is consistent with a world in which we need to focus our resources as much as possible on working-age Americans, and is consistent with a world in which we want to support a dynamic, flexible economy. So I actually think this is a great opportunity for the kind of discussion that we haven't had within the Democratic Party or across the nation more generally about what are the values that we want to achieve, what are the systems and structures we want to put in place to provide security to middle-class families. And just one point I want to emphasize is that this is, I think, in the long term, highly consistent with fiscal discipline, and particularly when you look at health care costs. Health care costs are a huge threat not only to the fiscal capacity of the federal government, but to the bottom line of American business. And everyone knows that if we fail to address this problem and fail to broaden coverage and control costs simultaneously, that in the long run we're going to be paying the price.
I want to get to that then. The Democrats are coming in talking about a higher minimum wage, and even President Bush is saying, yes, by 2009 we'll go up a couple of bucks. They're talking about, you know, negotiating on drug prices within Medicare and getting some money back from the oil companies. But you're referring to something with new forms of insurance much broader than those initiatives, Jacob Hacker, more on the scale of Social Security. What are you talking about?
Well, most of the ideas that I'm proposing are not anywhere near the scale of Social Security. The only proposal that I would support that would come close is an expansion of health insurance coverage. In my view, that should be done through a combination of securing of employment-based coverage for workers who have secure workplace coverage and a expansion of a Medicare-like program for those who don't have access to secure coverage. But I think we should have a debate about what the best direction to go on health care is. With regard to other ideas, I mean, I think that the two other areas where we see a lot of insecurity and we could deal with actually without spending a huge amount of money are job insecurity and the strains that working families are facing today. And there are good ideas out there for providing, for example, wage insurance to help people deal with economic dislocations or to provide paid family leave for short periods of time to help people deal with the strains of raising or having kids while they're working that would actually be relatively inexpensive.
And wage again, insurance sounds gigantic. What does that mean? Is that like unemployment insurance, which we're familiar with, or something else?
No, it would be something that would be coupled with unemployment insurance. Unemployment insurance has a grave defect, which is that it really doesn't help people get back into the workforce. And wage insurance, the idea of wage insurance is that if, as many workers who are dislocated from the workplace today, if you face a big drop in your pay or your benefits, you would receive some kinds of insurance if you took a new job with lower pay.
So in other words, the government would help keep your wages nearer where they were if your wages dropped. Will Marshall, that sounds way outside the bounds of Reaganomics to my ear. Now, is this the kind of new initiative that you as a Democratic centrist could support, or does this sound off the reservation you've lived on?
No, we in fact endorsed this idea many years ago, and in fact most of what Jacob's talking about are ideas that we support and we would add to the list. I mean, he's right. We have to think about a different kind of social contract. It's not trying to reweave the old safety net. Those big institutions, stable corporations and big powerful labor unions and a kind of expansive welfare state that the government operates, they're just not going to be there for you anymore. So you've got to develop new tools that you can equip workers with that will bring up the floor of economic security and stability underneath them. Jacob's mentioned many of them, and I think he's right. But look, let's not avoid the core problem here. I think it's a false choice to say you got to go back to the deficit hawkishness of the 90s or else develop this new social contract. You got to do both, because to pay for a new social contract, it's just not going to be easy. You're going to have to find the fiscal space for it. At the same time, you're meeting your obligations to the baby boom retirees.
How on earth do you do that, given what we've seen the budget doing in recent years, the cost of the war in Iraq and everything else? How on earth do you have it both ways?
Look,
Paul Krugman says, forget it, you can't. Republicans didn't. Democrats don't even try.
You got to do three things. First, we're going to have to reimpose budget discipline. We're going to have to have pay go. We're going to have spending caps. We're going to have to go after corporate welfare. We're going to have to get serious. You know, no more earmarks to just go to special interests. Secondly, we're going to have a fundamental tax reform. We're going to have to undo the damage that the Bush tax cuts have done, restore progressivity, and again go after tax benefits to wealthy folks and corporations. And thirdly, we're going to have to rebalance our commitments to the elderly under Social Security and Medicare. There's just no way to avoid that challenge.
Does that mean cutting benefits? Is that what that means?
Look, we're going to have to adjust future benefits. There's just no question mm-hmm. about that. You can't make the numbers add up any other way. We're going to have progressive cost sharing, meaning that people with more means are going to have to take on a greater
mm-hmm.
share of their providing for their retirement and health care security.
I want to begin to turn to our listeners. A lot of them want to join this conversation. Let's go to Kalamazoo, Michigan, and Steve. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Great topic. I got so many questions, but first of all, speaking of globalization, I'm in the manufacturing industry, and I see how NAFTA has greatly affected my industry and how so many companies in the Michigan area have moved to Mexico to lower wages to take benefit of that and get higher profits or to stay more competitive. Why did we make it so much easier to do business in Mexico? And specifically, what was the benefits to America? And also, I also do business with a company in Chile that is really happy about the privatization of Social Security. And I liked what Bush had to propose on Social Security, privatization of that, that it's self-funded. And I, what are your thoughts on that also?
There's a couple of giant ones, Steve. Thanks for those. Will Marshall, let me go to you first on this trade issue. You have voices in the Democratic Party. As you say, they've been there for a while, but they've grown louder saying trade and globalization are not working for the middle class in this country. Steve calls from Michigan and says, what about it? Where do you see the party going now that it's got the majority, Will?
Well, this is going to be a challenging issue for Democrats, to be honest with you. I think we are agreed on the general diagnosis of insecurity and growing inequality. But then there is disagreement about the prescriptions. There are some people who want to sort of, I think, demonize trade and immigration. And I think that's not a promising direction for Democrats. As Jacob said earlier, we've got to design new supports for workers that go with the grain of global competition and change, that allow us to be dynamic and flexible and innovative and to raise our game in global competition, not withdraw and succeed from it. And just as a point of fact, I don't know about Michigan per se, but, you know, U.S. manufacturing now is actually booming. Our exports are up $100 billion. What's changed here is U.S. manufacturing employment continues to decline as our factories get more productive, more automated, fewer workers. And so you see actually a very robust American manufacturing sector, but less manufacturing employment. So,
and those workers are exactly what we're talking about. We had Sherrod Brown on not long ago, Democratic senator-elect, congressman from Ohio for many years, late last year. Jacob Hacker, Will Marshall, let's listen for just a second to him talking about American trade policy and the interest it's sparked.
There's been a lot of talk about changing these trade agreements. We've never been able to do it. This is the first time that trade has been a major issue in many Senate races and House races around the country. There is not unanimity, but there's overwhelming support for a different trade policy among the new members of Congress, including some Republicans. And I think we're going to see a very different direction on trade policy.
A very different direction on trade policy, says newly elected a senator from Ohio, Sherrod Brown. Jacob Hacker, how about it? Can we change the insecurity and the inequality without looking at trade policy and the way America's participated in globalization?
Well, we certainly can't without looking at it, and we have to look at what benefits and costs globalization has imposed. And I think Will put it well when he said that there are both benefits from globalization and we have to look at the risks that it has created for workers. I think that the many Democrats and people who are concerned about these trends could agree that we need to deal with these dislocations that are created by globalization, and also to work to try to make American business more competitive, in part by removing some of the responsibilities and burdens on corporations that they are no longer eager and often willing to take on, such as providing good first-dollar health coverage. So to me, that's that's probably the best direction to move, at least as a first step. And we've not seen much progress on global trade for many years now. And I think that one of the reasons is that there hasn't been attention to some of these worries about insecurity and inequality that are part and parcel of the globalization debate. So I guess I would go for the primary problem, and I do think that we can address it without necessarily really fundamentally clamping down on the openness and dynamism of our economy. I wanted to return just quickly to a point Steve made, because I think it was interesting that Steve is concerned about the growing risk that's caused by the decline of manufacturing employment and the move to services. And we no doubt Michigan has been one of the most hard-hit states in this regard. And yet, at the same time, he was seemingly embracing the idea of privatizing Social Security, as President Bush proposed last year. That, I think, was actually a watershed debate in this larger discussion, because it was one of the cases in which Democrats of all stripes came together to say there are bedrock principles that we want to support, and that while there may be ways in which we could increase the returns within Social Security, or there may be ways in which we could create new private accounts on top of Social Security, we shouldn't jeopardize that basic bedrock idea of having a secure retirement benefit that's guaranteed. And as we've seen private retirement pensions move away from that older principle, it's all the more important to preserve and protect Social Security. And I don't think that there's much disagreement among Democrats about that. I was struck by the New Direction for America statement of the Democratic majority in the House in their 6-for-06 plan, that they put retirement security and dignity right there in their top priorities, and said, and as did all of the Democratic candidates who won this year, that they would stop any plan to privatize Social Security. I think that's the right choice, and I think we should have a debate about how we make private retirement pensions, whether they're add-ons that are to Social Security that are done through government or sponsored by employers, we should think about how to make them more secure and a better complement to Social Security, which frankly doesn't provide a particularly generous benefit, and it's going to decline in value over time.
We've got a lot of listeners who want to join us as well. Let's go to Berlin, Connecticut, and Elizabeth. Hi, Elizabeth. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I would like to start out by saying, in order to address the middle class insecurity and instability, as Americans, I believe we need to take a novel approach.
Okay.
We need a new model for our society, and that starts at the cornerstone of any society, which is the family. In our society, as Americans, each generation and all family members within are expected to have their own house, their own car, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We need to look more at the model, for example, in other countries in Asia, for example, where two or three generations live together. They pull their resources together. The combined effect is it crosses over, it bridges many sectors of society, such as healthcare, financial.
So take care of each other, share the car, hunker down in the family a little bit. Elizabeth, let me ask you, do you see that as a way to a better life economically, or is that a kind of permanent retrenchment?
I absolutely do not see it as retrenchment. I see it as a means of actually strengthening the family unit individually, which is the building block of our society.
Does it mean you don't think the government can fix this, that it has to be fixed at the private level, addressing these problems?
Well, I think it needs to be a collaborative effort between the government and the private sector. But I feel that I think this is a good model. There's a lot of benefits to be had from it. I also think that if laws could be passed that would allow health coverage to cover two generations, aging parents, for example, by working middle-aged people, that would be a great place to start.
Elizabeth, let us pick it up with Jacob Hacker. Jacob, how do you respond here? Is this the personal responsibility ethic of the Reagan years still going strong in Elizabeth, or something else?
I think it's something else. I think it's a return to an older ethic that said that really these problems should be dealt with within the home. And of course, that ethic had a dark side, which really papered over the huge inequality that occurred within families, particularly between men and women. But there certainly is a value in what Elizabeth is saying, and we've seen actually a bit of a move in that direction in response to these strains. We've seen more kids living with their parents, for example. We've seen a huge amount of money and time being devoted to elderly parents by working adults. In fact, there was a story in the New York Times a few days ago about this trend and how much of stress it can impose on working Americans and particularly working women. I don't think, though, that this is a solution in itself, and for a number of reasons. One, I think our whole structure of social policy isn't very well suited to helping families, and so we do need to have more of a focus on helping parents, helping people who are caring for their aging parents, helping working parents when there are two parents in the workforce, and also giving people the tools to save on their own is very important. But I think most of the tools we have today, the tax breaks and the like, are very much focused on the upper end of the income distribution, not on middle-class families. But the reason I think that ultimately this has to be a broader solution is that there still are a lot of risks that we face that really emanate from outside the family. They're inherent in our economy. They're inherent in the processes of change that are occurring within our society. And it's very difficult for us to sort of close off our family or even our extended family from these trends, things like, you know, massive waves of economic restructuring or catastrophic health events within the family are really going to be a source of fundamental and huge strain for an extended family unit. So there's an important element of truth in what Elizabeth is saying, but I think that we need to look further and think about both how to strengthen our policies with regard to families, but also how to help families through broader policies of insurance that extend across all Americans.
Let me take a call from Marblehead, Massachusetts. Patrick is calling. Hi, Patrick. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Good morning.
Hi.
Great program. Wish you could go on all day. Just a short observation. I was listening to Barney Frank yesterday, and he made a mention of the rising tide raising everybody. And
he spoke at the National Press Club in Washington.
Yes, he did. I was watching it on C-SPAN. Mm-hmm. And he also mentioned that people who don't have a boat, the water goes up their nose. And I said to your screener, I said, I'm in the middle. I do have a boat, but now I think I'm spending a lot of my time just bailing out a lot just to keep the boat afloat. I'm not rising up and I'm not going down. I'm just trying to stay even. And that's where we're at, I think, in the middle class.
So what do you expect from the Democrats now that they've got this majority? Not the White House, not a big majority, but they've got a majority. Do you expect American policy to change in a significant way to change that?
I think, frankly, the middle class needs a bit of a psychological lift. I think, minimum wage. I love the idea of the lowering the interest on education loans. That's what affects people in the middle. People in the middle are shoving water out all the time just to keep up. We're not getting ahead. We're trying to keep up. And those kind of plans are what are going to work for us. Maybe they won't change the world, but they'll change people's perspective, I think. And that's what people need right now, I think.
So a little boost. Patrick, we've got it, and thanks for your call. Let me go to Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and Bonnie. Hi, Bonnie. You're on the air.
Hi. Great program. Two ways that we can get more money into the economy through tax revenues. One is to get the money back from the corporations that have made billions in profits in Iraq without producing what they were paid to produce. The other is to stop corporations from being able to avoid taxes by putting their headquarters outside the U.S. There have been 32 U.S. patents issued for tax avoidance strategies.
Patented tax avoidance. That's wild. Jacob Hacker, how about it? On the corporate side, it's been a very good time for corporate profits. Are Democrats, should they be eyeing American corporations as a big piggy bank to address some of these issues? Or is that a kind of anti-competitive strategy?
Well, I think that they are going to be tougher with American corporations, particularly with those corporations that they feel haven't been responsible or playing by the rules. There is a big emphasis on ending what are seen as tax giveaways that encourage American corporations to take jobs overseas. And this was an issue, you may recall, in John Kerry's campaign. I think that the other area you're going to see a lot of attention is on those corporations that they feel are really adding to the problem. That would be oil and gas companies and even more immediately, because we're going to have a debate about this soon, the drug and insurance industry, which they feel has got a really sweet deal in the Medicare prescription drug bill. But I think in the longer term, and this was reflected, I think, in Barney Frank's emphasis on a new bargain, that there's a willingness on the part of Democrats to respect and listen to corporate America. And I think that the hope is that this new contract would be one that, while it wouldn't be embraced by all of corporations, would respond to their very felt need to lower their labor costs to be competitive in the international arena. And I think that focusing on health care is a really good start for Democrats, precisely because it's an area where business is as much an arm up in arms as many Americans are about the rising costs they're facing. I think risk is that we're going to see a degeneration into a debate over whether or not this is going to be helpful or hurt business. And really what we should have a debate about is whether it's going to be helpful or hurt the middle class. And if we have that debate, I think the Democrats will give that shot in the arm to the middle class that the previous caller mentioned.
Jacob Hacker, stand by. I want to bring in a voice very big. The last time the Democrats were in power in the White House, Robert Rubin joins us from New York, Treasury Secretary from 95 to 99 under President Bill Clinton. He's now Director and Chairman of the Executive Committee at Citigroup. Last year, he started the Hamilton Project, a think tank based at the Brookings Institution focused on broad-based economic growth, Rubinomics, named after this man. Robert Rubin, thanks very much for joining us.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Democrats taking the gavels back on Capitol Hill today. We heard a lot about starving the beast in the George W. Bush years, that the Republicans would, you know, run up the deficit so high that there wouldn't be anything left over for a change in direction if and when Democrats ever came back to power. Has the beast been starved? Is there room for Democrats to change American policy or not?
Tom, I think there is. I think my own view, and this is, I think, the kind of debate we should have, but my own view is that what we need to do, we have significant deficits right now, and we face, in the next decade, a pretty rapid increase in entitlement expenditures as a percentage of the total economy, as a percentage of GDP. And I think what we should do is construct a path going forward with respect to which the deficits are brought down so the debt relative to the economy, debt relative to GDP, as a percentage of GDP, that line comes down rather than going up as currently would be projected to be the case. And at the same time, we make room for critical public investments that will promote productivity and help address the stagnant real wages, which unfortunately has been the reality for most Americans.
And what do you say then to the so-called neo-populists in the Democratic camp who say, come on, Bob, that's just not going to cut it. There's not enough in that sugar bowl to bring down the deficit and retool to be competitive. There's just not enough to go around. Paul Krugman says, forget about the deficit. Republicans don't care. Democrats shouldn't either.
Well, Paul's article, if I remember correctly, said that good economic policy would be to bring the deficits down, and then he said what you just said. I guess my answer is that I know what my answer is. We ought to do what works best for our economy, because basically, as President Clinton used to say, the best social program, and it's also the best program for middle Americans, is to have a strong economy. But then we also have to focus on these distribution questions, on stagnant real wages. And I think the best way to get a healthy economy is to do both at the same time. Now, the question of, and I think then, Tom, it raises a question of what that path will be. In other words, how long a path will you give yourself to lower deficits and thereby lower debt as a percentage of the economy until you get to balance? And I think as long as you have a reasonably lengthy period, not an unduly lengthy period, but you have a reasonably lengthy period, then you can also find the resources to engage in critical public investments. Now, you do then face the question of whether you want to restore some of the tax cuts that have been put in place over the last few years. And it's been my view, I've said this publicly, I think that the tax cuts for the top two brackets, which is something less than 2% of the American public, that those ought to be restored to where they were during the Clinton years.
And that would go down to what kind of income at the low end of that?
I think the low end of that, don't hold me to this, but I think the low end of that's about $200,000 a year, $225,000 a year, something like that. And you certainly, I don't think you can plausibly make the argument that that's going to hurt the economy. We raised taxes, we being the Clinton administration. In 1993, our opponents said it was going to create a recession, and said we had the longest economic expansion in the nation's history, and we had enormous job creation and rising incomes. And I think we could raise those two brackets back up. It is about the top 2%. It's about 200,000.
Do you think Democrats can do that, will do that, politically in the run-up to an election, presidential election?
I honestly don't know. Well, the two separate questions there. whether they can politically and whether they would want to politically. I really don't know what they're going to do in that respect. It's what I would do, and it would give you more revenue, and then I would use that revenue to do two different things. One, get on a path toward reducing deficits, and two, engage in critical public investments. I think the other things, by the way, you can do to create revenue, too.
Jacob Hacker, I'd like to hear a little intergenerational conversation between you and Bob Robert Rubin. Here he is. You know, he had the boom last time. But, of course, a lot of the trends you write about, Jacob Hacker, did not entirely change during that time. So what do you say or what do you ask of Robert Rubin? You know, you're the new intellectual light here, Professor Hacker. Is it back to Rubinomics in your view, or is it something else that you would see in what you call it the new social contract?
Well, I would think that Rubinomics would change in this context, and I, in listening to what Robert Rubin has said over the last few years, it has changed. I mean, this very strong emphasis on public investment that certainly was a part of the Clinton years, but which has become more pressing, is, I think, a very crucial component of the emphasis on fiscal discipline. I mean, I think there may be differences between us in terms of where we would put the emphasis and in terms of how quickly we would want to bring the budget in line. But I think that ultimately that we could have both a strong economy that provides security and equality, a greater equality, and have fiscal discipline. And I guess the one question I would ask is where he thinks healthcare fits into the picture, because to me that's the one area where we can most clearly see that failure to have any action, and much less failure to have bold action, is putting us on a path that is unsustainable, both with regard to entitlement programs like Medicare and more state-based programs like Medicaid, and with regard to business costs.
Robert Rubin, Clinton tried that, got in a lot of trouble. Can the Democrats pick it up now and win?
I think it's critically important. I know Jacob and I know each other. We actually have worked together in the context of the Hamilton Project. And I think Jacob's got it exactly right. You have to find what balance you want between deficit reduction and critical public investment. And you might have had one balance in 1993 and a different one today. He and I might have slightly different ones. But I think we'd still be basically in this same ballpark of having to try to do both and then deciding what your balance is going to be. I think healthcare is critical, both because it is a tremendous cost problem for American business, and also because both for economic reasons and social reasons, we should have universal coverage in this country in one fashion or another. Now, exactly what kind of healthcare system you want to have gets to be a somewhat complicated question.
Do you see, Bob Rubin, the Democrats linking arms on this? Or you know the tensions that are out there around trade, globalization, where everything's going to go. Barney Frank warns business, get with us in a hurry or you're going to see a political whirlwind come and bite you and maybe us too. Do you see Democrats sticking together during the period of this very difficult balance you're calling for?
Well, I think this. I spoke to Nancy Pelosi, the speaker, invited me to speak to the House caucus the first week of December. Which
I heard you had a rough ride there, we read.
No, that was somewhere. they were very gracious to me. I thought it was a very, very good session. They were thoughtful. They were serious. A lot of their constituents are having the problems that Jacob has talked about. And those problems do need to be addressed, and they have not been addressed. So I actually thought it was a very good session. Some of the reporting of it, I'd say, was somewhat at variance with the tone of the session itself. Do I think the Democrats will stick together? I think the Democrats have a heck of a lot more than unites them than divides them. They certainly agree on the importance of economic growth, but also on getting much better distribution of the benefits of growth, and as Jacob has emphasized so much, on increasing security. I think trade is always going to be a difficult issue, but I think that there are ways to bring this together. And I think the Democrats could very well. I think Democrats can stick together, and there will always be outliers. I think they can stick together within broad ranges, and I think have very important debates about economic issues, which is what we should have.
Well, the gavels will open up a Democratic majority era today for a couple of years at least. Robert Rubin, former Treasury Secretary, thanks very much for being with us.
You are more than welcome. I've enjoyed being with you. Thank you.
And Jacob Hacker, author of The Great Risk Shift. Great to have you, Jacob.
Thank you. It's been a real privilege.
This is On Point.